I am so delighted that we are recording this evening so that so many others will have a chance to hear Nancy Mellon, who is joining us to talk tonight about digestion, imagination, and resilience, and her wonderful work and her new book. And so I don't want to waste any more time. Nancy, please please share with us what you have tonight. And I'm going to put myself on mute so that I can listen to.
Well, I'd like this to be as much a conversation as possible. I've been discovering over these past years how storytelling communicates with all the different bodily processes, as I think you probably all know, and it's really been quite a learning path for me. So I am still on this path, of course, with everybody else. So, but we're in a huge national epidemic of eating disorders of all kinds, with so many permutations of digestive distress and challenge, which occurs on all the different levels, because digestion is a very comprehensive process, and it's something that I am understanding more and more fully, that that all the different levels of our being are so closely woven with one another, and that when we have indigestion on a subtle level, that it can turn up on the physical, and that if there's some kind of impediment, too many potatoes or something or other on the physical, that that can also turn up in the emotional and in the mental world, and it can very much impact our relation with our higher dimensions of ourselves as well. So digestion is definitely a comprehensive process, and it's easy to be focused on one of those levels and think that that is really where the problem lies. But actually, probably the storytelling activity is one of the best ways that we can unlock the and unblock the larger digestive drama that we're experiencing every day, digesting our experiences, digesting the past, which is something that we do quite fervently from time to time, the larger version of who we are and have been, needs to go through a big loop of digestion, so that we can discover who we become through all our many experiences. And so there are so many ways to look at digestion through our biographical stories and through the metaphorical stories. I've had opportunities to experiment with a number of stories connected with the digestion. Some of these stories have arisen spontaneously, but I thought I would start by giving a picture of this marvelous old 13th century Irish tale, the saga of Micomhairn MacLinn, who I've briefly described in the book Body Eloquence. When Ashley Ramsden, who's a marvelous storyteller and a wonderful person to work with, who founded the School of Storytelling over at Emerson College in the UK, in England, when we worked together with these Body Eloquence courses, we came up with the possibility of acting out this story, which is about a king who has a vast eating disorder, and everything in the world that is edible is of great interest to him, because he's a king, he can have it all. So he, but he is, at the beginning of the story, he's really suffering a great deal, because he has lost all control over his appetite. And so we acted out this story, and people have volunteered, sometimes two or three at the same time, to be this ravenous king. And then the great poet, Macon McLean, many have tried to help the king, you know, and relieve him of his terrible distress, but the great poet, when he arrives, knows how to handle this situation, and he enlists an agreement from the king that they will fast together for one night, and then as the dawn comes, they place the king in manacles, so he's completely bound down with chains, and then the poet and someone or two are acting out the poet, will invite all the cooks of the realm to come in and bring their enticing dishes, and to describe these dishes as vividly and enticingly as possible. So then we have the people parading in front of the manacled king, you know, but bringing wonderful language, poetic as possible, to each dish that is waved under the nose of the king. And this this parade of enticing dishes of all kinds goes on for as long as it goes on, and as long as we can stand it in the group. And then at a certain point, the king's mouth becomes bound open, which is an interesting situation where the jaw is just, it just can't close anymore. It's a ravenous open mouth. And then because of the skill of the poet and all of his helpers, the demon, the ravenous demon, the endless loop tape, that's tapeworm, you know, tape or whatever it is, that's within the king, it's actually seen as a slimy demon, shows its head in the mouth of the king, and then the most enticing dish is brought out, and the person who is acting out this demon then kind of falls out of the mouth of the king, and then the demon is bound and then sent away into the desert, and then the king is free, and so we acted that out, helping people. Different people taking different parts, and it's always had not only a rollicking but also a very sort of a tonic and beneficial effect. And for people who have hidden or or not so hidden eating disorders, it's actually been quite amazingly therapeutic to work through that story, and also have. The tremendous enjoyment of it, but also the deep and even horrifying seriousness of it. So we live in a society now where many, many people are addicted to food, or in different ways, and out of control, because they are not able to find real satisfaction in the eating process with actual food. And at this point, I would like to mention our beloved Brother Blue, who, of course, he had the opposite. He was at the opposite end of the spectrum. The great storyteller was recently passed on, whom I will honor for all my life. As will so many of us, for his wonderful, sublime benefit on our appetite for life and story. But Brother Blue would rarely eat a thing. In fact, one of his wife's continual projects was to get him to take a little morsel of food, any food at all, because he was so nourished by, might say, the higher process. He was really living in the spiritual nourishment of food. And his story of how he found his way into that bliss of the higher nourishment. I mean, he didn't drink very much either, and lived really on stories and on his mission to bring stories into the world. Jackson, who was with us, he and I both were at the memorial service, which was very recently, changing the nutritional soul of the great city of Boston. But the spectrum from eating little material food and living on a spiritual nutrition, or more on a mental nutrition or an emotional nutrition, and the other end of the spectrum where everything turns into something to eat, the entire landscape turns into something to eat, is the challenge of we all have of moving between those extremes. Years ago, when I was giving a workshop and learning how storytelling can be a real authentic healing art, there was an extraordinary man who came with his wife to this evening course, and he's a tremendous teacher, actually, in the Cambridge area, teaching many people very successfully. But he had an eating problem, and so he told us about that. He said that a day couldn't go by when he didn't eat at least 5 or 6 books. And that when he sat down to a meal, that it was never enough. He always felt like he had never eaten enough. And he said he had gone back and he realized it had something to do with his childhood, the way that he was brought up, that his father wanted him to know everything, and his mother wanted him to eat all of her food, and that to satisfy them both, he had developed these voracious appetites for books and food, and there was no rest from it for him. And so, and his wife agreed with all this, because he was trying to keep up with him and his appetites. And so I always take an experimental attitude toward creating stories. And that evening, I just said, as I usually do, I said, well, let's see if your storytelling self can work with this and do something about it. And so I've learned over the years to help people be in touch with their larger storytelling self. And that's a series of, you know, relaxations and opening of the different portals. And so the relaxation for him was particularly important, you know, in the context of others at the end of the day. And he did relax a little more than usual. And then he launched into this story. And he had a partner in the group whom he didn't know, So the two of them, they were going to share stories. And I gave them a plot line, a basic plot line. And he created this amazing, disturbing story. And he said, oh my, after he finished, he said, oh my God. And he was just sitting there stunned and breathing very deeply, and amazed at what had transpired within a 3-minute story. And the story was about a man who'd gotten into a train, and he was hungry, so he so he went to the dining car and he ordered a meal, and then he was still hungry, so he ordered another meal, and then it still didn't feel like enough, so he ate all the food that was in the train, and then he ate the train. And then he got out of the train, and it wasn't there anymore, and he was still hungry. And he was wandering in this landscape, and he came to a hill, and he started climbing the hill because he saw light on the other side rising. And he had almost gotten to the top of the hill, and there he saw a beautiful girl, a young girl, a very small girl who was climbing, toddling over the lip of the hill. And he walked to meet her, and she ran to meet him, and she threw herself into his arms, and that was the end of the story. And then he was able to see that you know, analyzing a story isn't necessarily the most important thing to do after a person has really experienced a comprehensive kind of shifting of their experience of themselves after they've told a story. But he was, after a little while, and his kind of consciousness filtered in more, and he said, oh, I can see, that's it. Exactly, that's my daughter. She brings me into my heart, and then I'm not so obsessed with my appetites because I feel so happy and so satisfied. And so that bringing balance and perspective into the appetite is just an amazing theme. And of course, there are these two wonderful books that expand on all the different aspects of the eating problems. This Eating in the Light of the Moon by Anita Johnston. And if you've never read this book or haven't read it lately, it's really, I've been going through it again. It's just a wonderful book for guidance and being with different kinds of, you know, eating disorders, Eating in the Light of the Moon. And the other that I recently have been rereading is The Hungry Self by Kim Chernin, which has been around for a long time, and since, as I think, 1983 or 4 or so. And she really explored in a very honest and deep way the eating problems that began back in the 80s and that have not actually, you know, this has not been a passing phase. Now that is even more a problem today than it was back then for both men and women. And I've been working recently with a man whose father came from Russia as an orphan, and his father had experienced extreme deprivation and starvation in his childhood, And so when this man was growing up, his father was influencing him, of course, a great deal. And then the father had a breakdown, and this man really wants to create a story of himself which is freer from his father's misery, left over from all the childhood deprivations. And so he's now in a process of looking at his own eating pattern, which is to gobble food as quickly as he can, as much as possible, and then to go back to work as quickly as possible, and the feeling of having a starved, insatiable body. And so he's in the process of transforming that legacy of starvation, no food, and he is successfully doing that through working on his own story. We haven't gotten his own literal biographical story, and we haven't yet gotten to the point where he makes a more metaphorical story, but I think we will get there one of these days soon. So there's so many of the old stories are about starvation, because it used to be a much more common experience, the actual physical starvation. Of course, now we have emotional starvation, we have the mental glut and the spiritual deprivation and starvation that that many people are suffering from. But we have these stories that are the classic stories of starvation that still can be helpful when looking at the other levels of starvation as well. And one of those is plain, Hansel and Gretel, and a very, very literal losing all of the nurturance of their parents, all the safety that the parents should be providing, and they're left alone in a wood where there is no food, where they can find no food. So they're in a kind of a desert situation, deserted situation, and then they go their path, and luckily there's the white bird that leads them to this mysterious house, which is guarded by the witch, and this is the house of sweetness. And it's very interesting, because I know you all know the story, so I don't need to go through it, but from my perspective now, because of my inquiries into the way the different aspects of the self are connected with the physical processes, that this sweet house, this house of sweetness, is also the place where these children come into themselves in a new way. They discover strengths that they didn't know that they had. They discover that they are able to, together and individually, to meet this very destructive threat and to to burn it, and in the process to coming into touch with the treasure, the jewels of a new power, tremendous new power, which then they are able to bring back to their father, who is no longer ruled by this destructive mother. They're able to find in themselves powers where they can meet the starvation and the threat of death and go on, and guided by the white bird. And it's really, to me, the spleen process that they're involved with, the transmutation, transubstantiation, really, in a certain way, of their child blood into a more mature, enlightened blood capacity that can find their way and survive this dire threat. And it's so interesting to their very being, and it's so interesting to me that this story has been a favorite for so many, many years, because it speaks to this need that all children, the child within us all, has to know that no matter how dark a world that we can wander into, that that this place can be found where we can. Find within ourselves the powers to outwit the darkness, to burn it into a new inner light, and then to go on, and in the going on to find our way to the arms of love, which is really the ending of the story, of love and acceptance and new life. And so if they hadn't eaten that sweet house, they'd taken, nibbled on that sweet house and brought out the witch, they also would not have been able to find these new powers. And the immune system works very much like that, with that danger evokes these immune cells that eventually learn how, or even very quickly study and figure out how to deal with the destructive element and to bring in the higher powers of the self and to claim the treasure and find one's way onward. So this Hansel and Gretel story is going on within us all the time, actually. So I've been very interested in these ways that the family stomach, the communal stomach, and the general stomach, socially speaking, into which we are born, can take over, and we have to go in sometimes into this dark wood in order to find our own individual relationship with our own treasure, our own relationship with food, and that brings in our ego strength and our greater sense of resilience. And finding one's own individual relationship with the whole nurturance process is part of the building of our resilience. So that's a little offering from me. Shall I go on some more here?
That is so much, and I know people will want you to go on, but I thought maybe we could just see if there's any thoughts or questions at this point before you share some more, Nancy.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Would anyone like to ask anything at this point?
This is Nayana, Susan. It reminds me a little bit, there's a children's story called The Land of Chew and Swallow.
Mm.
And everything is food. Everything comes down from the sky and it's food.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't have to work for it. And when they don't use the food wisely, then the sky god pulls back.
Yes, that's a great story from Nigeria. They're probably, there are probably versions of it in other cultures as well. When the food is given, it is simply given by the great sky god. It's given and then, and everyone receives exactly what they need. But when the sky is not respected, when the source of the food is not fully honored, and people take more than they need and are careless with food, then the sky god becomes angry, and he threatens that people must take more care and show more respect, and still, when they are careless. Then at the end of that story, of course, the sky god, he doesn't make it so easy anymore, and people have to start to work and to till the land and to find their own food, because he will no longer just supply. I feel that my African voice coming up there when I'm telling that story. Yeah. So, and actually, it's so, what I've learned is that when our stomach is really, really active in our whole personality, when it becomes active, and so for some people, the stomach activity really fills the personality in many ways. Life can look like a lot of food. You know, you visit a landscape, and what you're really interested in is what is edible there, or how to make everything more edible, to make a bigger garden, to take the fallow land and make it fertile so that everyone can feed well, and will be very well supplied with the help of the sky god. That's a great story. I have a little version of it in the book Body Eloquence, under the stomach chapter. The land of chew and swallow.
Nancy, what are the names of the two books you recommend? The Hungry Self by Kim who?
Kim Chernin, Chernin. It's a wonderful book. It's called, it was in 1983, but it's a classic. I'm sure you could find a copy of it.
And the
subtitle
one was
is Women Eating and Identity.
Women Eating and Identity.
Yes.
And the other book, the author?
That is Eating in the Light of the Moon. And her name is Anita Johnston. Wonderful book.
This is Lanny. Nancy, I have a question around when you are working with somebody, how you decide, and again, this sort of feeds into eating issues and whether one is full or empty, but when you offer a story versus when you ask for their story.
I almost always try to create the situation where the individual can create the story for themselves, because I think, especially if they're in real difficulty, that is the very best and actually most efficient way to go about it. But as far as group work is concerned, it can be, as I described in the beginning, tremendous fun to act out a story or work with a story where everyone is telling the story, practices the story, coaches one another with a story, and the story then has time to, because of the practice and the coaching in the group context, that people have a time to commune with that story, and then perhaps they could do their own journaling. And it depends on what kind of state people are in. You know, if they've got a very serious problem, then there needs to be an opportunity to talk and reflect and so forth. I mean, I was working in a largish group over at the School of Storytelling, and there was there have been a number of people there who have eating disorders, you know, big time, and this woman, her mother's alcoholism suddenly started erupting for her, and I looked at her, and she's a very sturdy and a very dear person, but she was suddenly looking drunk to me right in the middle of the class. And I looked again, and she's still looking, and her head began to roll. And later that day, we were working with the stomach themes, and later that day she came to me and she said, "I really must talk to you." And she said, I'm so nauseated. And then her story came forth that she, when she was a girl, she was cleaning up her mother's vomit from all of her alcoholic excesses, and that had been very much the story of her childhood, was tending her mother and cleaning up after her sometimes. And so then while she was talking about this, the nausea started coming out of her, and I had to go and get a big pan, and she really just let it all out. She let the story out of the truth of what she had experienced as a child, and with it came her mother's vomit and her own, you know, her own nausea in response to her mother's vomit. Sorry to be telling you all this, but you never know what might erupt when one's in the midst of these themes. She's much better now, by the way. But she had to go. She went through a lot then, and then after that, she got some more help so that she could really deal with what she had suppressed for many years. it's complicated, you know. I mean, it can be complicated. Where does the story? As one of the marvelous stories in Eating in the Light of the Moon, which, by the way, has remarkable, wonderful stories relevant to different aspects of eating disorders. One could share a story like that, and you might not know what personal story would then arise from a person, and to create a safe context so that their personal story doesn't erupt into the whole group. You know, that can be important, and where they can tell their literal story. One of the people that I learned from about and developed most strength for working with eating disorders is a Brazilian woman who specializes entirely in working with food and biography. And she calls herself a biographical counselor. Oop, the thunder and lightning is just pouring down here suddenly. She's a biographical counselor who specializes in the food, the relationship with food, and she helps people to tell their biographies entirely through their food experiences. And she works with them in her marvelous kitchen. And so they, so sometimes cooking is part of the healing process. Cooking together is part of the healing process. And she does some wonderful work. She's in London, Vera. And one day she will write a book about her adventures, helping people work through their nutritional biographies. She herself tells her story that she'd grown up with a mother whose eating patterns were and her food drove her crazy because her mother's emotional life was just very difficult for this little girl. And it was only in her early teenage years that she began to visit another branch of the family. And she adored being there and sharing food. And that was her first experience of happy eating. And before that, she'd been completely, now it's hailing. Wow. Oh, my goodness. We suddenly are having a hailstorm. A big hailstorm. Can you hear the hail again?
Yeah. Nancy, where are you?
I'm in New Hampshire. And I had no idea this was a big and noisy surprise. It sounds like very large pebbles are being thrown at the windows. Anyway, she... because she had such strong contrast in her experiences, she had been a real anorexic child, and she discovered the joy of cooking and sharing and eating with happy people. And so it has become a life work for her to help people to tell their stories, to work with their stories, and to transform them.
Any other thoughts or questions?
Nancy, this is Joan.
Hi, Joan.
Hi. I'm just loving everything you're saying in this whole way of looking at the stomach of life. A question came up for me as you were describing the man you were working with who had the Russian father and the deprivation, and
mm-hmm.
you're saying you're working with him and he's still in the process of telling his story biographically. You're still working with him biographically, but that you feel that the metaphoric story might be coming soon.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious, what are sort of your indicators or intuitions or hunches about when someone is ready or how to move them from biography to metaphor?
Well, I think that...
I'm going to mute because of my dogs here.
Oh, nice to hear a California dog. and a hailstorm on the East Coast all at the same time. I think not everybody needs to go to the metaphorical story level. But I sense that he will want to do that, he's asked to work with me because he senses that that's something that he will be wanting to do. I believe that. There's a healing dreaming process that takes place, when the dreams begin to release, when the dreams begin to speak to his conscious mind, he's beginning to get a dream image. That is a very good starting place for a story, because there's such a very fine threshold between the dreaming, the healing dreaming process, and the storytelling process that will come from him. So I would tend to wait until an image arises spontaneously from within his own being, and then just very delicately and respectfully invite the story process to continue out of that. That's going to be working with him. In groups, when the atmosphere is safe and clear enough, and people are paired up with one another to create a story around a certain theme, I'm always amazed and astonished that the healing images will come from one person or the other, if there are two are working together, that with a tremendous efficiency that these healing images will come, and out of those the stories can be built. So I think there's not any one rule here about how to do this, but if I'm working individually with someone, not in a group context, I tend to be very careful to look for the initiative to arise from the person themselves, rather than from me to suggest or impose a story. And that's just the way I do it. I know that isn't the only way.
Very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Joan.
Nancy,
yes.
Can you hear me?
Who is this?
This is Carol.
Hello, Carol.
Hi. I do a lot of this improvisational storytelling with children, young children. It gives them the opportunity for their stories to be told, and it's just so rich. It's just amazing, the healing images that come out of them,
yes.
And that the child starts, I'm thinking of one that I wrote about in the Lane's newsletter lately, is that this child who starts talking about sharks and getting eaten and all this stuff, and
yeah.
He suddenly starts saying he needs the key. He needs the key, and that's such a powerful healing imagery, the key.
He what the key?
He needs the key, a key. Help, I need a key.
Oh, my, yes.
And for, over and over and over again with children, it's just so amazing. They start with all this story that has so much turmoil in it. And then just by kind of going along with them saying yes, and seeing what they say next, always healing images, healing elements arise.
Isn't it amazing with the almost speed of light efficiency that those
yes.
images can arise at?
Yes,
speed of sound, anyway.
Yes, and even the little words like, and then a helper came, and this, immediately they'll come up with a helper.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just give a little suggestion.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
They always respond to that.
Mm-hmm.
This is
well in your presence. Your presence is helping that to happen for them because they
yes.
have to trust you.
Yes.
So they trust themselves because they trust you.
Mm-hmm.
The enjoyment of what's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the stomach is a great producer of images, and the whole digestive process, which of course includes the intestines and the liver and the spleen and the gallbladder and all that every one of these digestive realms is really that. It's a kind of royal realm, and it it has a life of its own. And when it's in distress, particularly, it will tend to want to draw attention to itself through creating images, which maybe stay, you know, on the dream level, but can push themselves into consciousness. And then the antidote also, the antidote is also being created from deep within the whole soul physiological process and soul spiritual physiological process. And so there's a story dynamic there between the indigestion or the blockage or the dyspepsia or the voraciousness and the cure for that. And I'm always amazed at how these healing images, astonishing healing images, can arise and descend, circle around, you know, whatever direction they come from. So the children have it, but we all have it, you know. The elders have it. It's how we're made as human beings that the problems and the solutions are constantly playing, and the story can reveal those through pictures, those dynamics through pictures over and over again.
In so many ways, again, Nancy, this is Lanny, I'm thinking of the title of your book, of A Body Eloquence, and that seems to be what you just described, is the eloquence of our own body to hold the problems and the solutions together, if we know how to listen and hold that, and story is a powerful tool to do that. I want to thank you so much tonight for sharing your eloquence and your wisdom with us. It was so rich and engaging, and I thank you all for joining us tonight, and stay tuned for what's coming next in future teleconferences to be announced as soon as we figure it out. But you will be able to access this recording immediately through dialing in again, and it will be on our website soon, which will then be a free way to access it. But Nancy, thank you so much for being with us tonight. And
Lainey, thank you. Thank you so much for setting all this up and persevering with it. And I feel privileged to be part of it and to be able to speak with you all this evening. So I wish we had more time. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you all.